The second spoken Dharma wheel is right livelihood, which in practice means relaxing, generating a sense of relaxation, a sense of safety and peace, support. Support always has to be a little bigger than challenge. So that's why I say don't give more than 49%. You need 51% support, minimum. Maybe you just give 10% to start out with and 90% support. So right livelihood, you know, like we sometimes might say to people, well, what do you do to support yourself? You know, where do you work? That might be an old phrase. People don't use it. Well, what do you do for support? Oh, I'm an accountant or something. So livelihood means support, means relaxation, safety, establishing an experience of like settling in. Overall, a sense of peace. So that's why we have beautiful temple, feel safe, feel clean, people look safe. So that after we establish healing words and healing towards ourselves, then we go, oh, okay, it feels good. I'm safe, it's peaceful. Don't have to worry. Well, you can worry if you want, but don't have to worry. So, overall sense of relaxation. So, many times when people are starting the practice, they're doing like body scans. That's very popular now, which is a good idea. You know, people doing an internal scan, so to speak, like, is there any tension in your body that you'd like to release? And are you aware of your body? So relaxing, particularly in yoga, is really important. And it starts with the body. So we do a body scan. Usually body scans start from like the head, we think going down, right? That's fine. But then you also want to go up. So you'd start from noticing your feet or your butt on a cushion and then bring your awareness up through the body too. So not just like light coming down, but also things bubbling up. In Tantra, we always make sure that we're working both sides of the street. So it's not just top, it's also bottom. Things are always moving up and down. That's a really important factor. So when we do body scan, it's okay to kind of start at forehead and then notice. I like to do body scans that also include a sense of, well, it's okay to be tense there. So if you're doing body scan and you notice, okay, shoulders are tight, then we've already done some kind words to ourselves, so it's okay to go, well, I'm just going to be loving my tight shoulders. Thank you. Nice to meet you on the way down. You don't want to do a body scan where you're kind of going, oh my God, I got tight shoulders. I got to relax them. Don't want to do that. oh, you know, like, oh, gone, I can't, no, I can't do this. No, you just, okay, a little tight. And so you're making friends with your body, letting the energy come down. But then there's also energy from the earth that comes up. So we're letting things rise up too. And maybe things get relaxed, or maybe we're just relaxing behind the tension, right? So the point of doing the body scan isn't, and Vajrayana practice, Tantra practice, isn't necessarily to let go of the anxiety or the tension, but to create some awareness and friendliness around it. That makes sense, right? No. I've been on a rant all year. Well, last year too, like, don't tell me you're trying to let go of something. I'm just trying to let go. Okay. So, we also have to learn to hold on, right? Everything's going to always be. So if you say, I'm going to let go of my something, then what are you going to hold on to? So things are always that way in real life. So if you jump out of the airplane and let go of the airplane, you want to hold on to the parachute. Okay? You might even make a decision, okay, I want to hold on to that tension a little bit, because maybe that's reminding you of an emotion that you want to come back to, right? So when doing body scan, tantric style, we're going down and we're going up, and we're bringing that peace and friendliness to it. So we're not trying to necessarily get rid of something or let go. Usually when people say let go, they mean go away. Isn't that right, to your feelings? Like, I'm trying to let go of my anger. No, you're trying to get rid of it. So if it wants to go, it can go. If it wants to stay, it can stay. So that's, you know, internal. There's a fancy word in physiology, proprioceptive. That's a good word, right? Your proprioceptive sense of your body in space and what your internal experience is. You're probably hoping we're going to do the body scan right now, and we will. Just a few more things. I know. Like, can I just? If you hear something like that, you know, if you hear like, Lama's like doing body scan, just start doing it, you know. That's okay. You can do a body scan and listen at the same time. You don't always have to pause. That's another tantric thing. You don't always have to say, okay, I just have to stop, you know. Tantra is training for real life, so sometimes we're doing a body scan while we're moving or listening. We can actually do that. But I will pause in a moment. But if you have to do it, go ahead. Do it. So in these short workshops, you know, I've been emphasizing doing all the different styles of practice, but mostly from tantric point of view, right? And when we say tantric point of view, it means ultimately we're taking the result as the path. So we have kind of a Mahayana Hinayana title, Becoming Buddha, right? Is that the title of the workshop, I think? Yeah, which I kind of like, because we are Buddha, but we're also becoming Buddha at the same time. But in our tradition, we first become Buddha, and then we're becoming Buddha. In our tradition, I say a lot of times, visualize that it's already happened, and then figure out how you got there. Visualize that we've already Dalai Lama's already come, visualize, you've already become a Buddha with your own Buddha field, visualize that we've already had the temple, and then work backwards, then become that. Then, like, how did we get there? So in our tradition, we start from the result and kind of go backwards. Kind of like Merlin in the Round Table, King Arthur, you know, Merlin gets younger, goes backwards. So in our tradition, we emphasize we're already there, we're just uncovering being here. So we're already Buddhas, and then we're learning how we're becoming Buddhas. So in Bodhisattva tradition, particularly like that we're emphasizing in Lotus Sutra teachings is the Bodhisattva training isn't just helping others or developing good qualities oneself or just aspiring to become Buddhahood or recognizing our Buddhahood, but recognizing the Buddhahood in others. That's sometimes a little bit more challenging. I don't know. Sometimes people recognize everyone else is really great and I'm stupid. That's not our tradition either. So we don't say, well, I'm really enlightened, other people are really stupid. So I know we say that. In our tradition, Bodhisattva practice, we develop ourselves based on the fact that we and others are awakened beings and manifesting the qualities of Buddhas. And the more we recognize that and act from that place, the more we're going to be it. So that's called taking the result as the path. So the rituals and the decorations and temples are kind of a stage set to what a Buddha's Pure Land would look like, the way it was envisioned in Indian, particularly Indians of the Buddha's time, and even now tend to like color and bling. Flowers, incense, perfume. So when you read discussions or read discussions and descriptions of Pure Lands there, you always think about, well, who would want to live there? It's all jewels and shiny objects and things like that. But it's meant to describe the experience of having fresh, clear, awesome perception and living in a sense of delight. So that's why we do this. We create these beautiful environments which are meant to give us the sense that we're already there, which we are. So it's very easy to summarize Tantric Path. This very body is the Buddha. This very place is the Lotus Land. That's easy, right? Okay, it's hard sometimes, but if we don't say it's easy, you'll think you have to create it instead of uncovering it and letting it blossom. So it's based on that view, this very body is the Buddha, this very place is the Lotus Land, that we do a body scan. That makes sense, right? So let's just take a few minutes. I'll ring the bell for those bell lovers. There are no bells, and there are no gongs like this in traditional Tibetan monasteries. They're no, you know, the singing bowls. Those were invented in but it's nice. So down and come back up. So general visualization is a little bit like rays of light or dripping, amrita dripping down light, or a gentle rain, and then on the way up, the traditional is sometimes like bubbles. So it's very, very gentle body scan. Just a few minutes. In our particular tradition, we train to starting out at least short time periods. Usually like 6 minutes, something. So that we know we always have enough time to do at least something, right? There's even a good book out. I don't think it's Vajrayana student, but like 1 minute meditator. You know? So we don't train. In other traditions, they train like just you're training to 45 minutes or an hour or something. But we train to start off really small. So in some sense, we always have time to do something. And then everything else is dessert. So maybe you're doing it already, but one way a body scan is done is on the out-breath, we're kind of going down, and then on the in-breath, we're drawing the bubbles up or drawing the energy up. Maybe people are already doing this, but I want to suggest you add that, because in the advanced tantras, there's a lot of talk, practice around downward moving wind and upward moving wind, you know, regulating these movements. So we even in our right livelihood, peaceful thing, we want to like be trained to that a little bit. You don't have to do it with the breath, but there does seem to be a little bit like going down the breath as it goes out and a little bit, you know, up. So you're drawing up on the in-breath and down on the out-breath for body scan. So those are feeling kind of petals coming down, like these banners are meant to be flower petals coming down. When the Buddha preaches or becomes awakened, preaches Lotus Sutra, the flowers come down, flower petals, or rain. A lot of times you hear a rain of Dharma. R-A-I-N, rain, and then coming up, bubbling up, emerging. we get used to this rhythm of the breath. All the Dharma teachings, even if they sound very abstract, they're all connected with some kind of actual lived experience. So they're going to be connected with some kind of embodiment experience. The metaphors are meant to help us connect with our actual lived experience. So, and like, just quick aside, like in the advanced tantras, when we bring things into central channel, it says seeing fireflies. People, you're not actually going to see fireflies. You might, but, they're trying to come up with, like, what's it kind of like to have this kind of experience? Well, it's like seeing fireflies, but if you see fireflies, okay, that's kind of interesting, but it's a metaphor. You don't have fire. There are no fireflies in California, are there? No, back east. People seeing fireflies? They're kind of interesting, It's weird, that bioluminescence, or kind of like seeing northern lights. A little bit surprising. So, fireflies. Okay, let's do the body scan. Just using breath down. Maybe going down like gentle rain and then coming up like bubbles. Or maybe coming up like indigestion. Right. Hopefully bubbles. So when we first come to like here, workshop at home, you want to just kind of sit there, even to start, even before like prayers, you're just kind of sitting there, right, for a second, just kind of dazed or something, letting, the sleep time, dream time, and the awake time kind of blend together. So you always want to spend time, that's kind of like pre-meditation. It's kind of like, wow, I'm still alive, so that's an important time to gather, let things gather. We're not doing anything formal, we're just kind of, and then we start. So you really don't want to jump out of bed. Are there any bed jumpers here? You don't want to do that. Bed jumpers, okay. Well, lie there for a minute and then jump. just so you get that kind of like, that kind of bardo state, in-between state, where, you're kind of like, not sure, am I awake or is this a lucid dreaming? Was that the alarm or, what, like that? If possible, to just give, let it have like a little gap, right? So when we do these kind of things, like a little gap there, then when we're talking about, kind of so-called more advanced practices like the Bardo teachings, right, the in-between states, then it'll already be kind of in your body as the natural kind of thing. See what I'm saying? So if you go, well, now we're learning about the liberation and the Bardo, and we do this and do this and do this, and now I'm reading the book by Robert Thurman, or then you have it integrated into your daily life, creating these gaps. So it's kind of a Dharma Disneyland thing. So we're always trying to like just return to a natural state. So we're referencing things we're doing naturally. So we're waking up a little bit and we go, oh, okay, this is not quite sure who I am or who's sleeping next to me, but okay, and then I'll find out eventually. And then we're awake and then we get out. Maybe just a minute, 30 seconds, but then the bardo states you're noticing kind of naturally. Just like the body scan. So it just becomes kind of natural. Breath out, and you're just kind of scanning, feeling, you know, inhabiting your body, and then breathing in, you're bringing it up. So it becomes part of natural life. Let's have quick questions, and then we'll do some walking meditation, which, by the way, you don't have to walk if you don't want to. Walking meditation is optional. If you want to take a break, go out and have a cigarette or something. Just kidding, don't. It's Earth Day. So that's okay. Or just sit there, go to the bathroom, snack, you know. So walking is just kind of something we do that's stretching. It's virtuous if you're doing mantra while you're walking and so forth. But you don't have to. Isn't that nice? You don't have to. But maybe there a few questions or comments before we do that. It could be it. Well, that's a good question. I mean, it could be like just an actual 6-minute shamatha. Or let's say you literally only have 6 minutes. You could just sing the refuge prayer, and and then meditate for 5 minutes, and then it could be compact, or you might just do kind of quick visualization and then Om Mahong, and then you do meditation, and then so it could be literally 6 minutes, or it could be 6 minutes of shamatha. Lots of times it's technically 6 minutes of shamatha, you can train yourself just to like quick reference to what you're doing, and then 6 minutes, and then give thanks, gratitude at the end, and you're done. Well, that's why I always say, we generally always have time to do it. Something. Hi there. Oh, yeah, good. That's good, yeah. Yeah, use the mic.
So, I was hoping that we could start practicing with the mic to ask questions, and I'll turn it down. This is really, really high. But that way they can be on the recording so people can hear them, and we'll practice a little mindfulness waiting for the mic to get to us. if that's okay. Okay. We'll see how it goes. I don't know. Sometimes you get so anxious you want to answer, ask that question. So. Oh.
Yeah, good. Also, when we're doing sitting meditation on cushion, you know, like you don't always have to be in like lotus posture, you know, like Peter and Susan, Taruka Allen, you know, kind of knees up. You know, that's I've done a lot of retreats like that. You know, where you're kind of, you know, sitting that way, right? So generally the only it's kind of traditional, but don't even worry, you know, the only thing that they don't like people doing in Vajrayana temples, you're not supposed to point your feet at the lama, right? You know, that would be disrespect, but you know, people a lot of times, you know, you just have to, you don't always have to sit in lotus posture or when you're on the cushion. And very advanced people, they're so, I say advanced maybe, but like some people can actually, like cats, they can actually put their head down on their knee and fall asleep. Do you know people like that? They can do that, you know, so you could rest like that. You can just kind of go down like that. Doug, did you have a question? Oh, you're holder. Okay. All right. So let's take a break, and we'll walk during the break, but people can also do what they want to do. So about 10 minutes walking. Yeah. I'm going to talk somewhat about Dhimmo practice, one of the six dharmas of Naropa, actually. Fairly advanced practice, but starts simple. also, a little bit about in-between states, Vardo, and Tibetan, easy to remember, Bardo, Bridget Bardo, I don't know, what would you remember? So when you first wake up in the morning, you know, we don't know exactly, are we awake or dreaming? We may not know exactly who we are or where we are. So we don't want to skip over that. that's like a transitional state, in-between state, right? So that's why even sitting down, waiting for the Lama to come, or waiting between things, we're just kind of sitting there like, I don't know what's going on. You know, we're between things, right? That's a very important state, you know? Like, we're not sure exactly what's happening. We're in between things. No one's told us what the next step is. Or we hear two different things. We're not sure, who's that? Who am I? What's that person's name? All those things that are happening daily. We don't want to skip over those. People are most interested in the Bardo, of course, between you know, physical death and rebirth. But unless we train to just the natural Bardos that are happening all the time, that will it'll be actually too special and too confusing at the time of death. So we're just training to the natural bardos of, like, I don't know what's going on right now. And actually, we don't. So it's a good thing. But we actually can clarify and have some wisdom about it, non-discursive, non-intellectual, direct, immediate experience of what it's like to not know exactly what's happening or who we are, and not to be freaked out about that. The misperceived self is always trying to establish itself and figure out what's going on. Constant struggle to have a plan, figure things out. So when we relax into our wisdom, our Buddha nature, we don't really have to know what's going on. In a conditional way, we already know what's going on, right? We're just here. Whatever's happening. So training to the bardo state, just like training to most states, you know, to really do dharma properly, we're recognizing these states that are happening, calling the states or these experiences that are happening in our daily life. And the retreat or workshop or formal training and practice is to, you know, bring those experiences into, you know, to polish them up, so to speak, so we're really appreciating them and using their energy. But it's not like we're creating something new that hasn't been there. So in real Dharma yoga, we're just bringing more energy and more attention to what's already there and using that for ourselves and for others. That makes sense, right? This is, yeah, so. Part of the reason for talking about the Dhimma practice is because this is in line with what I've been talking about in general, is developing enough energy so we can do our practice properly. So that's why I've been teaching some of the Salung practices, the yogas where we're doing the nine breaths. Does anybody remember in English what Salung means? Sa. Usually transliterated as TSA. That's easy. And then Lung, LUNG, Salung. Yeah, what does Sa mean? Channels. Lung means the wind, the breath. Usually translated as wind, so it isn't just identified with personal breath. We need enough energy, right? We all want a little bit more energy, except when we want to relax. But we need energy to relax, don't you think? How often do I hear people say, I'm just too tired to take care of myself? It's interesting. Yeah, just too tired to take care of myself. So, need energy to relax. Okay. However, the energy work is... has to be preceded by, of course, the healing and peaceful aspects of Eightfold Path, and has to be preceded by right intention. It's called, translated sometimes that way, or right thought. and I've been calling recently to try to help people. I'm calling it devotion, actually. So as I mentioned earlier, devotion is that right thought, right intention is we're seeing ourselves as Buddhas and seeing others as Buddhas. And we're seeing a Lama as a Buddha. So we're developing the emotional energy around this kind of idea of pure vision and what we sometimes call Vajra pride. So that our motivations and our emotion, our relationship and connection with each other is based upon how things actually are, which actually are as these enlightened qualities that we have, Sangha members have, and the Lama has, and we are. It's difficult and impossible to do the inner yogas, the tantric things, from a standpoint of I'm pathetic and other people are idiots, or I'm pathetic and they're geniuses, or I'm a genius. You know, we have to have the proper or right intention, the devotion, the emotional resonance, so that we can embrace ourselves as Buddha Bodhisattvas and others as Buddha Bodhisattvas. So overall, in a maybe easy way, this could be called confidence. Drunkpa Rinpoche used to have a big poster the size of one of these tankas, and the photograph was one of the temple guardians in Japanese temples. For those who've been to Japan, usually they're very fierce, strong-looking kind of Hulk beings that are very fierce, and they're guarding the entrance. And that's the one word underneath it was confidence. So sometimes in Sanskrit, the word Shraddha is translated as faith, and sometimes as confidence. So confidence, Shraddha, S-H-R-A-D-D-H-A, or S-R-A-D-D-H-A, Shraddha. Sometimes in India, you'll find someone whose name is Shraddha. So devotion, faith, confidence, this emotional ability to have the empathy and the relationship with our Buddha nature and others is essential for tantric path. And sometimes we use the term guru yoga to talk about the formal training of that, Tibetan to be Lama Naljor. Lama Naljor. Naljor is like Tibetan word for yoga, N-A-L-J-O-R, Naljor. Lama's translation for guru, so Lama Naljor. So next Sunday, I think doing a Lama Chopa for Geshe Damsha. Lama Chopa means like, you know, offering practice or ceremony, puja, right? So this third part of the eight-part path, confidence, the right intention, has to do with the ability to emotionally connect with ourselves and others. So that we have this view, emotionally connecting around our Buddha Bodhisattvahood, is analogous to it. Like if someone insults us, right, or does something, then we feel it, right? Don't we? You feel that, like somebody says, "No, I've just been ignored or insulted or dissed or something." We feel it, right? So we have some resonance with that. It's not just intellectual, usually. You know, it's not just usually like, "Oh, that person really put me down and insulted me. Oh, that's interesting." Usually it's more than information, right? So when we say we're treating ourselves and others as Buddha Bodhisattvas, it's not just information. We're supposed to have an emotional resonance about that. Just like if somebody was really kind to us, really loving, and we go, "Oh, wow, you know, thank you," or we're moved by something, we have emotional resonance about it, right? It's not just information. So if we are mean to ourselves, which we usually are more than others, actually, then we should feel insulted. "Oh, I just insulted my Buddha nature." It's like, shit, you know. So we want to have that. We have that emotional connection with our radiance, with our Buddha qualities, our Buddha nature, and with others. So just like it feels terrible when we're insulted and wonderful when we're appreciated or praised, we should have that emotional resonance with our Buddha nature. So it isn't just information or some philosophic concept or some just idea. Likewise with our teacher, you know, we have that same connection. And with the teachers that call, you know, Shakyamuni Buddha and so forth, is that emotional connection. Not emotion in the sense of, you know, the aversion kinds of emotions, but the felt sense, right? That's why in Asian Buddhism, traditional Buddhism, so much emphasis is put on developing that emotional connection with Sangha members, with one's lama, with sentient beings. So that becomes the foundation to do the higher practices, because if you do the higher practices and you don't, it's just information, then it's just information, you know. So when someone close to us says wonderful things, then we feel a resonance. Or when, you know, probably we've all had the experience where maybe at one point somebody says, "You know, I just don't love you anymore." Right? You know, it's like hits you like a ton of bricks sometimes. Like maybe you knew it, but then they say, like, "I want a divorce." And it's pretty hard to argue when somebody says, "I don't love you anymore." "No, you do." You know, they're like, they get an immediately emotional resonance, right? So, same way with, you know, when we hear, like, the truth about our essential nature, our Buddha nature, we actually want to hear, you know, we want to resonate with that a little bit, just like you're resonating with the gong. So it isn't just information. Then when we do the energy practices, the study, the insight, and the wisdom, then we've got the safety, we've got the healing, and the peace, and the emotional connection, the devotion, and the confidence, and then we're called, sometimes awkward translation, but suitable vessels. Has anybody ever run into that phrase in translation, suitable vessels? Suitable vessels sounds kind of like weird, but it's meant to go back to India, of course, where everyone's just carrying things around in pots. And if there's a leaky pot, it's really annoying. So many things in Dharma are like, don't be leaky. You hear that, you know, "Oh, that person still has outflows," when we're reading some of the Pali Suttas, you know. People run into that. some of the scholars here, there's still some outflows, or an arhat has stopped the outflows. These come from just normal kind of things where if you've walked like 2 miles to get some water, and you know, you fill it up and then on the way back it develops a leak, that's not good. So developing the confidence in ourselves as Buddha Bodhisattvas, developing a relaxed, safe lifestyle, developing healing speech, then we're ready, you know, we can carry the water the whole way. That makes sense, right? Okay. So basic idea of tummo, briefly. Is not just being able to, people have heard about it, it's like inner fire meditation. Tummo literally means, like in Tibetan, kind of fierce woman or brave woman, something like that. Lama Yeshe used to translate it as Kundalini. I don't know if that's good to use separate terms for things, but he was trying to relate to an audience in the 70s, you know, that term. And Sanskrit, it's a Chandali, which is more like, you know, inner fire kind of translation. But it's interesting, in Tibetan, like the mo, tummo, is female. So, you know, Pema Chodron, famous dude, her actual Tibetan name should be Pemo. Because you'll meet Tibetan men that are named Pema. And then you'll want to say, well, that's a girl's name. So don't say that to them. That should be Pemo. That's okay. I don't think she's going to change it. So very simply, we're not talking about initially generating enough heat so we can sit in the Himalayas or in the snow with just a sheet over us. If you go on YouTube, you know, you'll see people in Sweden sitting out. And of course, some psychologists and psychiatrists like Herbert Benson did go to Nepal and India and Ladakh and do some famous studies where the yogis were, you know, were drawing sheets. You know, that is something they might do as kind of a test. People know what I'm talking about a little bit. Like you're raising your body temperature so much that in the freezing cold, you know, wet sheet, and then steam comes out. So they actually have done physiological studies to see that, you know, some people, I guess, been able to raise their body temperature, I don't know, 5 degrees. More? I don't know. That's a lot, isn't it? That's a lot, you know. And then the idea being, well, Milarepa was just wearing a cotton, like this is raw silk, but like a cotton thing, like in the Himalayas, and that's all. But so he stayed alive by doing tummo practice, right? Staying warm. Maybe, I just think also he was just into being okay with being cold. So so the tummo practice is, I'm saying all this, that it's an inner practice to develop Buddha Bodhisattva realizations, not just to stay warm. And what's the warmth that we're talking about? We're talking about the blissful wisdom warmth that is also called like bodhicitta. So usually when we're talking about bodhicitta, the aspiration for enlightenment that bodhisattvas have, the, you know, wanting to benefit others, wanting to be of help, wanting to bring all beings to liberation, sometimes that's just a thought. But in Vajrayana, it's enlightenment as the body. So we talk about like actually generating warmth, generating bliss. So we do these visualizations and practices so that we actually feel the fire in our belly. That's a good expression because you know, when someone's passionate about something, we say, well, they're on fire about this. Or sometimes you use your phrase, not that often, but fire in their belly, like to really connect it with that energy. So the Tummo practice, we could call, you know, lighting the fire in your belly like that. Before we do that, a little bit of practice, maybe I ought to stop and see if I'm on the right track. A few questions, see comments going in a weird direction. We can use that microphone that Doug has. Okay. When people are quiet, that means everything I'm saying is making sense. All right? Okay, well, good. Okay, we'll keep going.
Okay. So there are people who tell me that they practice Kundalini yoga and that is their main practice. And I interpret Kundalini as the Tummo practice. And that's how I... So what is that is... Because it's really like everywhere.
Well, the Kundalini practice is... usually referring, you know, that term's used in Hindu yoga or, you know, Shaivite or, you know, yoga traditions like that, right? Yes. So, you know, it's sometimes called the coiled serpent, like that. And usually when people are talking about Kundalini rising, which has been really big since the 60s, you know, they're describing kind of blowout experiences of transformation and things like that, openings or maybe either abrupt openings or spiritual openings, you know, so talking about energy and so forth. I would call them energy practices, but and, you know, I'm not an expert on, you know, Shaivite and Vedic, you know, yogic practices. The thing is with Sanskrit and Buddhist and Hindu yoga, a lot of times the same terms are used, but totally differently. So generally, there's some correspondences, but... a major part of the Tummo is you know, bringing the breath into the central channel and developing this bodhicitta. So I'm emphasizing the, you know, not so much of having like some blowout experience that we then have to run to somebody to ask what was that, but developing experiences of warmth and bliss to such an extent that our sense of frozenness is melted. That's kind of the idea. Yes. Yeah, good. We'll get all the questions recorded this way. Appreciate it. It's got to be green.
Yeah. I had a similar question. I was going to just wait and see, but since Susan asked, I've done this practice called Breath of Fire, which I think the word tuma has been associated with, and I wondered if it's similar. It's a Kundalini, I think, family practice of more in a yogic sense.
Not really.
Okay.
you know, the fast breathing,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's some of that, you know. There's some of that, but these are all, you know, the Kundalini yoga practices Yogi Bhajan taught and his students, and you know, the yoga practices that are going back to the, you know, traditional Vedic style, Krishnamacharya, Iyengar, you know, Swami Satchidananda, you know, Ramakrishna. They're all doing something slightly different from the Buddhist idea, actually. Somewhat close, but the Buddhist yogas are taught generally to only to tantric practitioners that are highly devoted, that are willing to do the retreats, to do them properly. So I'm trying to introduce these as part of our ongoing practice, so we gradually go into them instead of going, well, when you're ready to do a long retreat, we'll teach them to you. No, we have to, you know, all the information is out on the internet and YouTube, and people are, you know, plugging their fingers into the light sockets anyway, so, you know, so to speak. So we have to talk about them and start, you know. I think it's been a good thing that, you know, the yogic traditions, Buddhist and Hindu traditions, are talking with each other, and I think some Westerners have done, and some Easterners too, but Westerners like Michael Roach have done a real disservice by confabulating and confusing the different traditions. And both the traditions are good. I'm not trying to say one's better than the other. We're just doing this Buddhist practice, but I don't think anybody likes to have ketchup on their ice cream. And you know, that's generally what, you know, what's happened to Michael Roach. You know, it's like that. It's real confusion, and then we see the result, right? I'm not afraid to, like, say that, just the same way as Dalai Lama, not afraid to say, please don't do Shogun practice, right? You know, we should have some things you just don't do, like, please don't hurt kids, you know, like that, right? We're not in favor of hurting kids, or we're not in favor of adult abuse or something. You know, let's not, you know, put ketchup on our ice cream. All the yogic practices have a lot of similarities in common, but they might, you know, combine in different ways. So, like that. The most, there will be some people who might have gained some realization in both traditions, and then they can speak accurately to it. That's to bed an idea. You know, you have these incredible teachers. It's kind of a little on topic, but detail, like incredible teachers, like Jamyang Khansi Wangpo, a teacher from the early 20th century, that you have these teachers that have mastered like whole different lineages, right? You know, or like Tsongkhapa or Padmasambhava, just teachers, yeshis, or, you know, like, not like they would learn totally how to play Beethoven's fourth piano concerto, and they could play bebop, you know. They can totally master different, totally different styles like that. But for most people, it ends up just being a mishmash. Like, you're just doing a little bit of everything and accomplishing nothing. But there are some incredible people that that have been able to do that, you know, can pull together and compare these different traditions and say something useful about it like that. It's interesting. It's a good question. I'm not saying anybody should stop doing what they're doing, but like, we'll get into it. Okay, good. So obviously, first place to start is we want to be aware of our tummy. We want to be aware of the particularly the energy around our navel and just below it. So the first start is just instead of thinking that we're meditating from our brain up here and looking down, you want to put you want to not just pay attention to that place, but imagine that you're being aware from that place. Most of us are, you know, when we think of paying attention, we still have this kind of metaphor like, I'm in my head looking down. Isn't that so? Yeah. That's totally a fabrication, right? You know, I mean, I know science and brain and nervous system, but we want to create this situation where your mind is in your belly. So you want to relax belly. This is the time not to be flat stomach. Okay. Yeah. And then, so where our mind is actually there, because when we do the visualizations of, you know, like maybe having an ember or something like that, if your mind's not down there, it won't work. If you're thinking, like some of the Kumar practices, if you're visualizing an ember with flames coming up or light pieces of, you know, kind of embers floating up, but if you're thinking your mind is up here and you're looking down, it doesn't work. You have to imagine your mind is there. I think that's a major accomplishment. That's why I'm spending some time on it. Major, like, so you're actually getting under instead of above. So understanding undermind instead of overmind. Your mind is center of consciousness for right now is down there. Can we try it? Does that make sense? Can you try it? Yeah. So it's almost like you're lying on the ground looking up. Yeah. Okay, we'll do that for a few minutes. Generally, it's easier to do, you know, to bring that energy and awareness when, of course, we're sitting in Dhyana Mudra, right? So, you know, instead of sitting Mahasiddha style with our hands on our thighs, you know, we're doing this, you'll find that you know, if your thumb's kind of a little bit right where your belly button is, and then sometimes it's called Dhyana Mudra, Cosmic Mudra, you know. I don't know where cosmic came from, but like this, and then just, you know, a little relaxed, and your thumbs are around your belly button touching, and then you're just kind of, your hands are just against your belly like that. So it's just going to make it warmer too, physically, actually. But, you know, it's just bringing it together that way. When we're having a lot of discursive thoughts for shamatha practice, generally, most people find that having our hands in Dhyana Mudra around our belly is grounding, right? It's creating a sense of weight and bringing. In my office at Middleway Health, I have a river rock. Sometimes I've had people hold river rock. So there's literally some weight there. Is it illegal to take rocks from the river? Maybe, I don't know. Is it? No, you can do it. You could probably take one, right? Go down the American River, get a nice, you know, and then you feel that weight there, right? It makes it sometimes easier to like come out of, literally out of our heads and just feel that weight. You can sit Mahasiddha style, but that's sometimes used more for like Dzogchen Mahamudra style, the opening, you know, it's literally more open, right? Hands out. You're concentrating. And of course, and we want to be doing, you know, belly breath, where our belly goes out when we breathe in. This is easy, right? I think it's hard. I think it's hard to switch from... This is a major thing. I think it's hard to switch from kind of thinking, you know, we're thinking the mind is here and then kind of looking down. What do you guys think? Yeah, you're focusing there. But it's not just focusing from being up here, focusing down here. You're actually being there. You know, what we normally think is, like, if the mind's really nowhere, actually, and everywhere, but if it had to be somewhere, it's here instead of between our ears, so we're not identifying with the brain. Otherwise, when we do the visualizations, when we say your mind becomes like a burning ember, or your mind becomes like sparks that flies up your central channel, you're still looking down on it. You're still identifying your mind with your brain and your head, right? And it becomes really difficult to get into the practice that way. I think that's a big switch. It's really major. You know, a lot of teachers in Asia don't talk this way because, you know, the mind is seen primarily in the heart. It's not as brain-oriented. Still, so we really have to consciously work at seeing, at least from a relative point of view, mind in a different part of the body. You gotta do it.
It's helped me actually. Well, I mean, just because modern science now is kind of taking more focus down there, and they call it the second brain. They've actually found brain cells similar, you know, that are down there. We have that whole network, and it's all interconnected. And the whole practice of the energy movement exercises, Tai Chi. I actually got to sit in a Kundalini ashram for a while, and. They do a lot of energetic exercises, but everything's basically related to that area just below your navel, Kundalini, or the Hara, whatever you want to call it. But, I mean, it's been verified now by science, so if that helps people. But there is a brain there.
Well, we've always said, what does your gut tell you? You know, like that. So, yeah, there's actually like the mind is all over the whole body, of course. But, yeah, there's a lot of linkage. Usually when we get nervous, we're going to feel butterflies, or we're going to scared, we're going to really have to pee or poop or something, you know. It's really, really connected. And we don't want to mess with our GI tract, really. Isn't that right? You know, we talk to a lot of surgeons, like, well, we can fix the heart and, you know, we can fix a broken bone, but, you know, like, even you can get a colostomy bag or you can do this, but, you know, if your GI tract goes south, you're really in trouble. It's true, isn't it? You know, so everyone wants good digestion. Looks like a labyrinth in there, so we need it. So yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
I thought it was interesting when you gave us the instruction, almost immediately I noticed the warmth.
Yeah.
And I wondered, is the warmth caused by the concentration there, or is the warmth always there and I just am totally oblivious to it when I'm up here?
This is where the Zen master would either hit you or give a big shout, right? Because it's really neither and both and at the same time. But definitely, you know, what we're doing in the formal trainings is we're highlighting and refining and enhancing what's already there. So I think that's, you know, an accurate way to think about it. It's already there, but we're enhancing it. We're bringing it more foreground so that we can, it's more available. So, like, I mean, all the furniture's here in the temple, you know, we're thinking chairs, but we're not, you know, so when we pay attention and you look over there and you look at the big black chair, the black chair just didn't appear because you saw it, right? It's already there, but then we're attending to it. So the formal practices, you know, that we're pointing out and doing or enhancing what's already there, making it available so that it's not just unconscious. We can bring it forward when we need it. And, you know, so good question, of course. But yeah, we're working on kind of hot belly, warm heart, and cool head. Usually the other way around, right? Kind of hot head, somewhat warm heart, and cold belly or something. It's even worse when it's cold heart, don't you agree? But we want hot belly, warm heart, cool head. Yeah. But we want to establish that the mind, temporarily we can move the locus of the mind, the reference point of the mind, around. Because honestly, if we do think it's just in the brain, then we will think more. We will generate more thoughts. I just think it goes, you know, we really, if the metaphor for the mind is the brain, we'll as it has been maybe last 100 years, you know, we will generate many more discursive thoughts. We might have to do it again. Yeah. So try to like do two things. Is we have you're actually feeling we're exaggerating a little bit. You know, where our abdomen is moving in and out because the diaphragm. So you're getting flexible muscles there. And you're imagining that the locus of your attention is coming from that place, and then your hands are there, and basically you're feeling heavy. In this society, it's not okay to be heavy, but we want to be heavy. So, like, nobody could pick you up, you know. You're so grounded, very heavy. So if you need to imagine like holding like rock, bowling ball, you know, holding a bowling ball there, try doing that. Do we need to go to the river and get some rocks? You know? No. Helps. Okay. Happy Earth Day. Is anybody going to have any Earth burgers today? That's good. Yeah. That's good. So in less than a month, some of us will be at Lotus View to be doing retreat. I think we're still taking registrants, aren't we? For those people that... want to do it, it'd be perfect, because through the workshops and what you've already learned, then in retreat we don't have to say as much, right? We just, I say, let's do this, and we just do it with not super lot of instructions. Oh, Monday night talks are long talks, and then workshops go into detail, and then when we do a retreat, we're kind of, in some sense, knowing a little bit pretty much kind of what we're doing, and we're just doing it. But I will be giving instruction, of course, all the way from Vipassana to Mahamudra, but the nice thing about being a retreat is we leave familiar surroundings and our beautiful outdoor surroundings, somewhat unfamiliar, so we'll naturally have a sense of openness and a little bit of bardo feeling, right? Where we won't know exactly, like, well, where are the utensils and where are we going to sit and like all that, right? So it'll be a natural bardo state, which makes it easier to practice, right? So I'm very appreciative to Ellen for sponsoring the retreat. I'm willing to have people sneak in and sneak out, because maybe not everybody can come the whole time. An important part of the retreat is to have that sense of practice and good connection, willingness to do the practice. So I think we have a deadline of maybe Cinco de Mayo, if we could know by Cinco de Mayo. May 5th for you gringos. So, because the retreat starts Friday night. Well, May 19th. Yeah. Less than a month. Retreats are not where we try to jam things in as much as possible, but has a sense of relaxation to it. A few minutes for questions and complaints. Sharing. You can share. This was fun. This was hard. Nothing happened. It's okay.
So because, you know, we're used to thinking of heart-mind connection.
Yeah.
So to bring your awareness, you know, to heart, which is also something that we're, like, I can visualize really easily.
Yeah.
Is not as difficult as trying to bring your awareness into the dantian. I mean, that's really, because we don't really think of that connection.
Yeah.
And mind, heart, but mind,
right.
Belly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was to bring your awareness, your sense of awareness to that piece was difficult.
Yeah, in this culture, too, we have this thing about flat bellies, and we really have to let go of that because we want a nice, warm, expansive belly like that. Also, some people have, like, belly issues, right? So, so we want a flexible, warm belly. Yeah, we want to love our tummies. That's really important. So when we're saying put our heart mind there, of course we mean not only just thinking, not just cognitions, but we're having the emotional energy, heart mind, from the belly. So we're loving our tummies. Do we all love our tummies here? Yeah, no, maybe not, I don't know. So this is not time to thinking, I want a smaller, flatter tummy. No, we want a nice, there's a sense of expansiveness and warmth. So I think it's hard to do as long as we have kind of conventional ideas about our body.
I found it more difficult the second time. I don't know if that's just, it's the concentration takes some effort to, you know, not just go into patterned thinking or what, but the experience was more profound the first time, and the second time I had to keep trying to get my foci center back to my abdomen. And I wondered if you had any advice on if it's a practice that I want to do with some longevity, will it keep being more and more difficult, or how does one have the practice be fresh each time so that it's, or what is that? Is it more hard the second time?
I Most of the time we equate spirituality or realization or mind with getting higher. And of course, in our tradition, you know, one of the metaphors we use is spaciousness and like that. But primarily we're you know, Dharma and human beings we're earth beings. So we walk on the earth and we sit on the ground, actually. So practicing outside is good. That's one reason it'd be good to be like outside. Maybe intrepid yogis even get their butts a little wet. You know, so you really feel like, oh, okay, I'm grounded. I've got the earth. Then it's easier, you know. So an important aspect is not just having in this practice thinking that, but feeling it, but also like getting a real connection with the ground, feeling our butt on the cushion, or literally, you know, going outside and, you know, getting kind of wet or something. It'll be dry maybe in a month, but, you know, just literally feeling the ground helps. Because the tendency is most of the time we are in chairs and insulated by some kind of carpet or something. We won't always be like Milarepa, who is literally sitting on stones or just earth or something. But, you know, sometimes it's not a bad idea. So it helps to just sit, you know, like, and be grounded, literally. So not only having hands in Dhyana Mudra, but, you know, feeling our thighs against or on the cushion or on the seat and developing that connection with earth. If we're not doing these practices a little bit from the very beginning when we start saying I want to do some Mahamudra Dzogchen practices, then we'll be in trouble because those practices are kind of ground's eye view. Like that. So it corresponds more to understanding than overstanding. Most of the time when people are talking to us or we're talking to them, we should say, I overstand you, or something, instead of understand, because understand, you know, we're actually placing ourselves under. So that's a good word for kind of like yeshe is kind of like, we say, you know, awareness, but it's like ground's eye view, in addition to sky view, of course, but we're on the ground. La la la. Yeah, good questions. Some people haven't made any questions or comments, so I don't know what you're thinking. I don't know if you're present. I think you are. At 11 o'clock, I think Brian's going to come and lead us in Vajrasattva practice, which is important. And I'm going to ask him to talk a little bit about how he and I work together on the practice, so we'll see what he has to say. I'm going to tease him a little bit. I'll just tell the audience ahead of time because I said, well, you know, sometimes very traditionally, like lamas would, just like the Buddha would say, oh, why don't you give a talk? And then the teacher listens, right? Lama would listen and then comment on the talk. I'm not here every Sunday or Monday or when other people are giving presentations, you know, so I don't know. But so it was a little difficult sometimes when our teacher goes, no, that's what you just said is completely wrong. Or sometimes right, you know, it's funny like that. But that's very traditional. You're just sitting there and then you say, okay, well, please give, in the monastery too, like, please give an exposition on this. Kind of like law school, right? and then everyone gets to comment on it. Anybody been to law school? No one's been to law school, right? Like that. So just to review, we always start off with just kind of arriving, not knowing where we've come from, like a bardo state. Like even when we sit down in a cushion or arrive in the temple, we're always kind of in this transitional place, right? And appreciating that, appreciating what it's like to leave from one place and go to another and kind of be in transition. So it's like leaping from one side to another. It's an interesting place. And then we do, you know, practices around healing, kind words, doing the prayers, saying nice things to ourselves. And then we're establishing, you know, a sense of relaxation, doing body scan down and up. And then we're developing, you know, the emotional warmth around developing, you know, we're Buddha Bodhisattvas. Others are Buddha Bodhisattvas. Developing the confidence, developing the emotional energy around that. And then we do the energy practices, like this one. So the first four are the Eightfold Noble Path. That's easy, right? The Tummo practice is practices basically come from you know, Naropa, right? The lineage teacher, Mahasiddha Naropa. And that should be familiar to people who have started reading the Mahamudra verses. Ganges, Mahamudra, right? Tilopas. It's interesting. Mahasiddha fellow Tilopas giving instructions on the river Ganges to Naropa. And Naropa passed on these teachings. And one of the things that people run into, of course, is sometimes called the six yogas of Naropa, but actually it's translation like six dharmas or six doctrines. It's Naro Chudruk. Naro is like Naropa, Chu, it's not like dharma or doctrine, Druk is six. Those six doctrines, and one of the doctrines is Dhamma practice, right? And another one's the Bardo practice. Then we have, dream yoga. For people that do darshan, you know, I like asking people about their dreams, right? That's true, isn't it? It is true. So we don't look at our just dreams regularly during the day and then think, oh, I'm going to go fly to Nepal and do dream yoga with so-and-so Rinpoche or something, and you're not regularly doing as part of your just life. You won't really be prepared for it. So So retreats and workshops, of course, are intensifications of what we're noticing and aware of already in our daily life. Otherwise, it becomes like Dharma Disneyland. You know, it's just a special kind of thing. It becomes what we call in hypnosis state-specific. I had this wonderful experience while I was in India. But where is it now, you know? So, other practices, you know, the six dharmas, or, you know, luminosity and poa practice. Poa practice is transference, it's called. You're transferring your consciousness to, sometimes literally, to a pure land by sending your awareness up, up out of your crown chakra, you know. Some teachers specialize in teaching poa practice. It's very popular with some people, some lamas. there are outer, inner, and secret poa practices. You know what? Sometimes poa practice is talked about as, like, if you're not enlightened in this life and you don't have time to practice, then do poa practice. Like that. But other times people say, don't do the poa practice, because if you do it wrong, then you'll leave early. So let's wait until we get some poa instructions, you know, like that. So let's take it, we don't have to do walking meditation. Let's take, like, 10-minute break until, you know, start at 11. And I know in workshops, people need to chatter a little bit, right? If we don't allow ourselves to kind of, like, do that, then we go a little nutty. So we'll take, you know, 10-minute, like, talking break. It's important. You need to give space to do that. You need to kind of, okay, we're going to, talking yoga. Yeah, that's it, Doc, talking yoga. And then we'll get together. Yeah, very good. Okay. La, la, la. Cool. Why don't you say a little bit about what it was like working together to put this together? Yeah. So, in tantra practice, when we're among our fellow Vajra brothers and sisters, you know, we're really always asking the question, what's it like to be you, you know? So, you know, we're really answering the question, what does it feel like to be a bodhisattva Buddha, you know? What's your experience, right? Usually when we're talking in this kind of normative, objective way. This is what, you know, emptiness is, or this is what mind is, or this is what kindness is. But when you're among your fellow tantrikas, it should be like, well, what's it like being kind for you, right? We bring it into the actual situation. So we put ourselves on the spot, or on the line, so to speak. So you're on the spot.
Whoa!
That's on. Two years, almost? Year and a half?
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Well, we received the highest Tantra Yoga into Vajrasattva, and I
wanted to contribute in some way, so I kept asking about monthly practice for Vajrasattva, and kept pushing for it, and you know, I wasn't sure at that time, you know, what maybe I could do or what I couldn't do in terms of how long I'd been around the temple, the Sangha. But eventually I did say, hey, look, you know, I'm willing to do this once a month. That was sort of, you know, my intent the entire time, that I was willing to do the practice, not just asking to have it done. So I wanted to make sure I was clear about that. I said, hey, can we do this practice once a month? And then we started working on it. Well, as I recall, Lamala had said something about Susan working on it a little bit. And so I took the opportunity to try and put together some stuff that I was, you know, thinking about in terms of a practice for Vajrasattva, and presented that to Lamala. And as I recall, Susan and I had a conversation, and you said that would be a good idea for me to do that, since I would be the one doing the practice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And we started into revising the text. It was probably over the stretch of a month or two, maybe, you know, maybe 3 months even. And I recall we put it out there. Lamala, I think, passed it by a couple of other Sangha members, including Susan. I think Dana took a look at it a little bit as well. So Dana took a look at it. And we hashed out changes. And, I'd submit something, and every time I'd submit it, the Lamala would come back and say, no, we'd do this again. That was good. So we do it again. Kept building this practice until we got it to a point where the Lamala said, yes, this is all right. And we instituted it, started practicing it on a monthly basis. And it was good. It was good because I know for myself, when I'm doing something, I can be very focused on what I'm doing. Almost get tunnel vision in a lot of ways. Sometimes when that occurs, someone comes up with a different idea or a different view on something, I can go into a defensive mode, which I don't intentionally mean it in a confrontational sort of way, but it's more like, oh, okay, well, this is what I was thinking, A, B, C, D. And I recall at one point in time getting some of the changes back that I guess Dana had made, and thinking just that, oh well, this realizing that at that point that I needed to let this go because it wasn't just what my sadhana that we were putting together, it was for everybody. I don't think I've ever actually shared that with anyone, including Lama, but I do remember that point in time thinking, oh, okay, here's this. Oh, okay, I kind of like that. I don't like that so much, but this has been sort of put out to other Sangha members, and this is where we're at, and this is a good thing. And so I let it go, and it's I think it wound up turning out quite beautiful.
Yeah, good. There's a movie, now it's a musical, Billy Elliot, I think, about, okay. So, there's a point in the movie where Billy is a youngster who's auditioning to be in the Royal Ballet, and he's dancing in front of this committee, and the committee member, he stops and scan their committee members, say, well, why do you want to join the school? And the kind of goes, oh, I don't know. Finally, one of the committee members, woman, asks, what's it feel like when you're dancing? Then pieces. It's like electricity is running through me, something like that. So that's the experiential Vajrayana side. So there's the informational side. So you gave 90% information and 10% your experience.
Yeah.
So, like...
I know that's my typical...
Yeah. So it's good to have context. Took the empowerment with Kenshin Rinpoche, then the progress of doing this, and then you said it's beautiful, or you noticed a little bit of ego around, like, my sadhana, which would be ridiculous, you know. So that's your own private experience. So we've learned to share that more and more as tantrikas, you know. You know, what's our actual experience? But, of course, it's fine to have context, too, you know, historical context and who was there and what happened, but then what's it feel like, you know? What's it like to be alive? That's what's it like to be alive and awake, really alive. That's what we're trying to express and experience and real Dharma, you know, like that. At times awkward, at times, you know, blissful, very personal. It's always a very personal experience. We'll have Kenshin Rinpoche come back again. So when there's real connections with Lama, then you know, we have heart connection. We feel like, okay, now I've like got the credential, got the stamp. Kenshin Rinpoche is very very easy to relate to, and just kind of talk to, you know. So I've had the opportunity over the years to just kind of hang out with him too, you know, which is an important part of Dharma practice, is hanging out. Then you really see someone's qualities, like someone's kindness of just doing the little things. So I've always appreciated his presence. So he'll be back. Fun person. You know, usually you don't, traditional styles, lamas aren't telling jokes, you know. You know, that's kind of traditional monastery, but then when you hang out. So I like to hang out. People should always know if my door is open with a mental health or here, just walk in and sit down, right? Hanging out's important. Okay, let's start.
I take refuge in the Guru. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in the Guru. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in the Guru. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge until I am enlightened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the positive potential I create by listening to the Dharma, may I attain Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings. I take refuge until I am enlightened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the positive potential I create by listening to the Dharma, may I attain Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings. I take refuge until I am enlightened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the positive potential I create by listening to the Dharma, may I attain Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the joyful happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from holding some close and others distant. We recognize our innate, indestructible balance. We recognize we are off balance. May the surface of the earth in every direction be stainless and pure, without roughness or fault, as smooth as the palm of a child's soft hand, and as naturally polished as lapis lazuli. May the material offerings of gods and men, both those set before me and those visualized like a cloud of offerings of Samantabhadra, pervade and encompass the vastness of space. Om Namo Bhagavate Vajrasara Pramardane Tagataya Arahate Samyak Sambuddhaya Tayata Om Vajra Vajra Mahavajre Mahateza Vajre Mahavidya Vajre Mahabodhicitta Vajre Mahabodhi Mandropa Samdramana Vajre Sarva Karma Avarana Vishodana Vajre Soha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vajrasara Pramardane Tathagataya Arahate Samyak Sambuddhaya Tayata Om Vajra Vajra Mahavajre Mahateza Vajre Mahavidya Vajre Mahabodhicitta Vajre Mahabodhi Mandropa Samdramana Vajre Sarva Karma Avarana Vishodana Vajre Soha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vajrasara Pramardane Tathagataya Arahate Samyak Sambuddhaya Tayata Om Vajra Vajra Mahe Vajre Mahateza Vajre Mahavidya Vajre Mahabodhicitta Vajre Mahabodhi Mandropa Samdramana Vajre Sarva Karma Avarana Vishodana Vajre Soha. By the force of the truth from the three jewels of refuge, by the firm inspiration from the bodhisattvas and Buddhas, by the power of all the Buddhas who have fully completed their collections of both good merit and insight, by the might of the void, inconceivable and pure, may all of these offerings be hereby transformed into their actual nature of complete openness. On my right side is my father, on my left side is my mother. Those people and other beings I find agitating are in front of me. People and other beings I am attached to are behind me. All other sentient beings are surrounding me. I have in some way become preoccupied with my misperceived self and lost sight of my Buddha nature. I have allowed the profound openness of the sky to slip from me, and in so doing I have misstepped into unbalance. I have lost my way, and my actions have caused even grief to others. My heart aches as I see clearly through what I have done, betraying those virtues I hold most closely to my heart. I cannot walk this path that causes sorrow any further. With refuge, we take steps off the unbalanced path and the first steps on our return to balance. This is our safe direction. At all times, I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I take refuge in all three vehicles, in the dakas and dakinis of secret mantra yoga, in the heroes and heroines, the gods and goddesses, and the bodhisattvas of the ten bhumis. But most of all, I take refuge in my Holy Lama forever. Holy Lama, who has the power to liberate me, my inner master, holder of the Vajra, whose essence is great compassion, Lord of all migratory beings, to you I go for refuge. At all times I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I take refuge in all the three vehicles, in the dakas and dakinis of secret mantra yoga, in the heroes and heroines, the gods and goddesses, and in the bodhisattvas of the ten bhumis. But most of all, I take refuge in my Holy Lama forever. Holy Lama, who has the power to liberate me, my inner master, holder of the Vajra, whose essence is great compassion, Lord of all migratory beings, to you I go for refuge. At all times, I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I take refuge in all the three vehicles, in the dakas and dakinis of secret mantra yoga, in the heroes and heroines, the gods and goddesses, and in the bodhisattvas of the ten bhumis. But most of all, I take refuge in my Holy Lama forever. Holy Lama, who has the power to liberate me, my inner master, holder of the Vajra, whose essence is great compassion, Lord of all migratory beings, to you I go for refuge. With bodhicitta, we take steps off the lesser path and the first steps onto the greater path. I myself will become Haruka Vajrasattva for the sake of all living beings, and then I will lead all of them to Haruka Vajrasattva's supreme state. I myself will become Haruka Vajrasattva for the sake of all living beings, and then I will lead all of them to Haruka Vajrasattva's supreme state. I myself will become Haruka Vajrasattva for the sake of all living beings, and then I will lead all of them to Haruka Vajrasattva's supreme state. Out of the open space of Dharmakaya, the sky-like nature of mind, about 6 inches above the crown of my head, appears the seed syllable Pam, which transforms into a 1,000-petaled lotus. On top of the lotus appears the seed syllable Ah, which transforms into a moon disc. In the center of the moon disc stands the seed syllable Hung. Suddenly, the Hung transforms into a white 5-pronged Vajra with a Hung at its center. Much radiant light emanates from both the Hung and the Vajra, going out into the 10 directions and completing the 2 purposes, offering great blissful energy to all lamas and buddhas, and purifying the defilements of all sentient beings. The whole universe melts into light. This light then returns and is absorbed by the Hung and the Vajra. The Hung and Vajra also melt into light and transform into Haruka Vajrasattva. Vajrasattva is white. He has 1 face and 2 arms. Sitting in the full lotus position, he holds a Vajra in his right hand and his heart and a bell in his left, which rests in his lap. His consort, Dorje Namyakarmo, embraces him, her legs encircling his body. She too is white and has 1 face and 2 arms. She holds a curved knife in her right hand and a skull cap in her left. They are both dressed in robes of heavenly silk and adorned by precious jewel ornaments. They both have the seed syllable Om at the crown chakra, Ah at the throat chakra, and Hung at the heart. Brilliant light radiates from the Hung at the heart, invoking the divine supreme wisdom energy of all Tathagatas to the space in front of Vajrasattva in the form of the wisdom beings. Ja Hung Bam Ho. They become non-dual, the union of appearance and awareness, free from any fixation. The wisdom beings, who are the wisdom energy of all Tathagatas, joyfully sink into Vajrasattva's divine heart, becoming completely one, like a drop of water sinking into the ocean. Again, brilliant light radiates from the Hung at the divine heart, invoking all the initiating deities of the 5 families. O Tathagatas, please bestow on me the Haruka Vajrasattva initiation. Upon this request, all the Tathagatas hold up their initiation vases, which are full of the Amrita energy of divine transcendental wisdom, and the Amrita starts to flow. Om Sarva Tathagata Abhishekata Samaya Shireya Hung. the divine body of perfect absolute wisdom, Guruka Vajrasattva, is completely filled with the Amrita energy of blissful transcendental wisdom. Some Amrita overflows and transforms into Akshobhya, who adorns Vajrasattva's crown. The initiation deities melt into light and sink into Vajrasattva. At the center of a moon disk at the divine heart stands the seed syllable HUM, encircled by the 100-syllable mantra. O Bhagavan Vajrasattva, destroyer of all defilements, who has attained all realizations and has passed to the other shore, I request you to please purify all negativities, vices, and suffering, and broken and damaged pledges of myself and all other sentient beings. Having been thus requested, brilliant light radiates from the mantra rosary and the hung at the divine heart of Vajrasattva. The light purifies all negativities and obscurations of sentient beings and becomes an offering for all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. The essence of the perfect qualities of their holy body, speech, and mind, all their transcendental knowledge, wisdom, returns in the form of light that sinks into the hung and the mantra rosary at Vajrasattva's divine heart. From the hung and the mantra rosary, a stream of blissful white Amrita energy begins to flow down through the central channel to the divine couple. The Amrita flows out through their secret chakras in union and flows into me through my crown chakra. Flowing down through my central channel, this stream of transcendental wisdom Amrita energy fills my whole body, destroying all negativities and defilements of my body, speech, and mind. These are completely purified. We'll do 21 recitations. We'll start with the first one out loud, and the remainder will, can be done silently. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tenopatitra Drido Me Bawa Sutokayo Me Bawa Supokayo Me Bawa Anurakto Me Bawa Sarva Siddhi Me Prayatsa Sarva Karma Sutsa Me Chitam Shreyam Kuru Hung Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarvatatagata Vajra Mami Munsa Vajri Bhava Ma Sahamaya Sattva Umbe. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tenapatitra Dvido Mebawa Sutokayo Mebawa Supokayo Mebawa Anurakto Mebawa Sarva Siddhi Me Prayatsa Sarva Karma Sutta Me Sitam Shreyam Kuru Hung Ha 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 Bhagavan Sarva Tathagata Vajramami Mutsa Vajribhava Ma Samaya Sattva Humpe. Short mantra will do 108. Om Vajrasattva Hung, Om Vajrasattva Hung, Om Vajrasattva Hung. Om Vajrasattva Hung. Non-dual divine wisdom, magnificent inner jewel ornament of all mother sentient beings, supreme, unchanging, everlasting great bliss, indestructible, magnificent wisdom mind that releases all sentient beings from all negativities of body, speech, and mind, especially broken vows and pledges. To you, glorious Vajrasattva, I prostrate. Vajrasattva says, O child of good family, your negativities and obscurations and damaged and broken pledges are cleansed and purified. You are restored to your pure Buddha nature. Guided by the wisdom mind of perfect freedom, from this moment on, without hesitation or reservation, I will abstain from all the errors that I can abstain from, and I will abstain from those that are extremely difficult for me to abstain from. For one day, 1 hour, 1 minute, or at least a few seconds. Now that I have sought for myself the antidote for my misguided actions, I will, as far as possible, go forth and atone for those actions, making available that antidote to those whom I have affected. Further, I will return to the refuge of Vajrasattva, again seeking his remedy for any future obscurations that divide me from my awareness and wakefulness. Dorje Nyamakarmo is transformed into light and is absorbed into Vajrasattva. Vajrasattva then melts into light and sinks into my heart. My three doors of body, speech, and mind become inseparably one with Vajrasattva's holy body, speech, and mind. Vajrasattva and I are completely one, and I enjoy the bliss of shunyata in full samadhi, beyond the dualistic view that discriminates between subject and object. We are home after a long journey. We are complete. We rest in unfabricated ease. Because of this merit, may I quickly become Haruka Vajrasattva and lead each and every sentient being into his divine enlightened realm. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. Because of this merit, may I quickly become Haruka Vajrasattva and lead each and every sentient being into his divine enlightened realm. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. Because of this merit, may I quickly become Haruka Vajrasattva and lead each and every sentient being into his divine enlightened realm. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrese Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. May the teachings of the Buddha flourish, and may the upholders of the teachings remain forever. May all migrators achieve happiness, and may they fulfill all their temporary and ultimate goals. Losan, magical display of the deep awareness of all the victorious ones. Merciful giver of a stream of profound and vast instructions to the fortunate migrators. Please remain always, unperishing, unchanging, unfading.
Okay. Very good. Nice. It's important, even when we're doing ordinary practice, to also do extraordinary practice. So doing Vajrasattva or doing any sadhana where we manifest in a Buddha Deva form is kind of like every once in a while, like, you know, dressing up. You have to dress up once in a while. Not just, it's okay sometimes wearing just ordinary clothes, shmata. Every once in a while we have to dress up for a special occasion and feel divine, actually. Feel like, you know, that life is magical and divine. I'm sure everyone here has had special times in their lives, either in formal occasions or informal, where everything, we felt like gods and goddesses. This is a special part of Tantra that is difficult for some other lineages to understand, who feel that it's important just to be ordinary all the time. Because ordinary equals being humble. But in our tradition, we have this extraordinary thing where we're gods and goddesses, Buddha Devas, and we're humble too. It's just we feel luminous and joyful and blissful, all the qualities that traditionally the Devas would have and do have, but with the wisdom and humility. So in Vajrayana and Tantra, we combine all these aspects. So we feel utterly fantastic. but at the same time completely compassionate and open. This is truly the tradition where we say, yes, we have it all. We want it all, and we have it all, because we feel that actually human beings do need to have it all. It's a need. Children don't say, just give me a little bit. Children always say, give me the whole thing. Isn't that right? Kids never say, well, just leave a little bit out, you know. No, they're always going to say, give me the whole thing, right? So that's, in disciplining ourselves, sometimes we say too much of delusions, but we never want to say, I don't want to have it all. That's the Vajrapada. You do want to have it all. You want to have the wisdom and the powers and the joy and the bliss and the radiance of the Buddha Devas. So it's important to do this practice, and we'll do it at the retreat too. It's fun. Yes?
If I could make a request, I did have a 5-minute talk sort of prepared that was rather technical. I'd like to give that, but I'd also like to maybe try and put it more into the personal realm, since, you know, that is what you said, suggested I should.
Yeah, let's see what happens.
Yeah? Okay.
We'll see what happens.
Thank you.
Let's see what happens.
Thank you to Lama Yeshe Jinpa. Thank you to Geshe Damcho. Thank you to Jada Rinpoche, and thank you to the all the teachers of our lineage and of Tibetan Buddhism in general, or Vajrayana Buddhism in general. With Vajrasattva, we often talk about good, you know, the essential good self. I think there are two goods that we're talking about here, and this thought sort of stemmed from a conversation that I had with Lamala on our last darshan, so hopefully I can communicate this in a way that is meaningful. There is, I'm going to borrow terms from philosophy. There is metaphysics, which is not the New Age metaphysics that you think of. In philosophy, it is discussions about the nature of reality. And the other part is ethics. So I think there is a metaphysical good that we're talking about here, and then there is a ethical good that we're talking about here. I think they both show up in Vajrasattva. What I mean is, when we say someone is essentially good, it means they have this Buddha nature. Everyone does, everything does, this Buddha mind, it's there. That does not necessarily, as I think we all know, make you a good person, or we wouldn't have, you know, jails filled with people who do awful things. But it gives you that potential to be a relatively good person. And that's where the ethics come in. You know, an ethical system, you know, the five precepts, for example, other ethical systems that we may follow due to our employment or due to, you know, just what we feel is the good way to do things. That's the relative side of things versus the absolute side. So for trying to bring this into more of a personal realm, I want to share with you what I think the one time, if at all, I have had a experience of the Buddha mind would have been back in, I think, 1995 or 1996. And my daughter was probably 96. My daughter was a baby at the time, and I was lying on the couch and just holding her while she napped. And something happened at that moment that it wasn't just the simple bliss of holding your child, but it was just all of a sudden everything was just okay. It was not just okay. It was, everything was blissful. Everything was beautiful. Everything was just, you know, filled with light. It was more than just, you know, these moments that you have with your children. It was something above and beyond that that words just don't do justice to. And if there was ever a time I think that I touched through to mind, I think that from the relative side of things, speaking, looking back, I would have to say that would be it. On the relative side of things, in terms of Vajrasattva and ethics, and Vajrasattva is a purification, of course, where you want to try and bring yourself more in tune with this Buddha mind, but also when you go out and you want to, you know, realize that you've done something wrong and that you want to touch someone else in such a way that you can hopefully make amends, as is evident in the Vajrasattva practice. I had an experience similar to that recently where I had to attempt to become Vajrasattva for someone else. Unfortunately, it was sort of, you know, not directly, but via another individual. A surgeon that I work with sort of disappeared a couple of years ago. I heard maybe about a year back that he had developed cancer, and he is now on his deathbed, and one of the nurses that is a good friend of his was talking about this, how he had went to visit him. He was very, very upset because he was in bad shape. I don't know if he's passed yet, but if he hasn't, he will soon. But something else that very much upset him was the fact that this doctor, who is by birth Jewish anyways, I don't know how much he practices, but on his deathbed, sitting there, by way of what this nurse told me, he felt he was going to hell because of the way he had lived his life. I sat with that for a while. You know, obviously I expressed my condolences to my friend and coworker, but I sat with it a while, and I said, you know, I should mention something. I should try to become Vajrasattva for this person. And I said, you know, I said to my friend Rod, I said, hey, you know, when you go, I don't know if he has any, you know, spiritual advisors, you know, anyone that's, you know, speaking to him, but, you know, maybe, you know, you can mention to him, hey, you know, or find out if anyone is trying to get him to resolve whatever these issues are before he does pass on. So I at least put that out to him, and in that way tried to become Vajrasattva for him. Rod thought it had more to do with his personality than anything else, and that, you know, that may be the case. And I don't, you know, who knows what he may be holding on to or not holding on to, or you know, what the reasons that he feels he's going to hell. But certainly, you know, myself and maybe not Rod either were close enough to him in order to, you know, really try and dig that out. But you know, Rod also, I think, gave me the impression that he's just too far along. It's a little too late to even do that because of his physical condition. But that's the way that I tried to become about this. Those are my couple of personal stories on the absolute side and the relative side.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Very good. Yeah. Now we get to eat. Generally, lots of times after the end of doing practices anyway, we have what's called a Gana Chakra feast circle. So when we're having lunch, if you want to maintain your vision of being a deva, a Buddha deva, then the food also has to be amrita, nectar, that is delicious and brings wisdom and has no calories, right? So, very good. Thank you for morning practice. This is like 4 hours is a traditional kind of length of, you know, time. People are doing traditional retreats. You do 4 fours, 16 hours of practice. I've done that, you know. But there are breaks. You know, sometimes when we're talking to friends, they're going, well, I couldn't sit for 4 hours, so we're not sitting for 4 hours, right? Yeah. But, we'll be back around 1 o'clock. Makes sense. Have lunch. Very good. See you soon.
Thank you.
So once again, it's like we're in a transitional state. Yeah. So in pre-meditation and post-meditation, there's a sense that you're not doing anything. So we're going to sit here for a moment, but don't meditate. Okay, is it possible to just sit here and not? Is that possible? Yeah, let's just try it. We're just kind of arriving. Let's just try it. The best meditation practice is the one you really do. And the real practice is what you do when no one's looking. So that includes us. So ultimate level practice is what we're doing when we're not looking at ourselves as an object. We're just being. But yet we've trained ourselves in a sense to catch ourselves in the act of being ourselves, to recognize our natural mind. So when we're not doing anything particular or waking up to that natural state. A lot of times we have to do formal practice in order to create some kind of contrast so that we begin to see the delusional world as it is and the real world as it is. We have to create some kind of differentiation. We have to create some, I call it like putting your, you know, when you were kids, maybe I used to stick my hand outside the car window to feel the air moving. I thought that was really cool. Parents generally want your arms to be back in, you know, kids would, I don't know, am I the only one that ever did that? Yeah, you know, and you're just got to do it, yeah, you know. So, yeah, that's fun too. Yeah, that's neat, yeah. So, the practices really are so, you know, we're doing something intentional on conventional practices. So we feel that, okay, there it is. But we also want to feel before and after. So that eventually we're able to be in the natural state, be aware without trying to change anything. But when we first start, usually we're in delusion, so we're bumping into things, creating karmic messes and hurting ourselves and others, so we have to do something. We have to do something to begin to separate delusional, destructive behavior from enlightened behavior. But eventually, we want them to merge, right? We don't want to constantly be checking ourselves. We just want to do our lives. So in basic practice, we do have to, basic calm abiding practice, beginning meditation, mindfulness, we do have to sit quietly, notice our wandering, distracted mind, and bring it back to the present. the present usually is easiest for most of us to find in our breath. So it's repetition of getting distracted and bringing it back. At some point, we're just going to notice thoughts arising and we won't chase after them. We're not after a point where we want to block out thoughts, but we're neither pushing them away nor grabbing after them. But for most of the time, we get a little bit hooked. And then we intentionally come back to our breath rhythm. Sometimes we have to even count. Traditional counting is actually 21. You count to 21. I think for some people that's too much, so I say 10 sometimes. You know, 21. But if you think you're a great yogi and you've attained high states, then consistently try to count to 21, start over without losing count, and see what happens over half an hour. Yeah, 5 minutes, yeah. So, you know, it's humbling, right? So just in this period after coming back from lunch or just arriving, we're generally going to have a lot of discursive thoughts, maybe sleepy thoughts, maybe exciting thoughts. But generally, it's like a second wake-up period. So we notice when we're caught in our pattern, and without judgment, we return to the now, our breath. The breath is important. The rhythm is really neat. We need to breathe properly. I've suggested breathing in through the nose, out through the mouth, relaxing the jaw. Letting the thoughts ride out on the out-breath. It's all happening without judgment or just training our inner puppy dog. So if you want to count to 21 breaths, usually, or 10, usually count like on the out-breath. But if your thoughts are really busy, you can count both the in and. If they're really, really busy, you can visualize the numbers like Sesame Street used to have, little colors, and the count, you know. So we're giving the mind something to do without a lot of discursiveness. This morning we did short meditations, and here we're going to do a little longer ones. So you'll find periods where you're drifting in and out of attention, getting sleepy, then feeling less sleepy, or maybe getting more sleepy. So we're going for a longer haul this time. So don't make it into a sprint. We're just going to do 24 minutes, right? It's not really long, but it's longer than 6 minutes. It's actually quite long. You know, there's no way we could run full speed for 24 minutes, right? Like run as fast. I don't even know how long I could run as fast as I can. Maybe like 10 seconds. Like that's it. Even 6 minutes would be a long run, right? Okay. So when doing shamatha practice, mindfulness practice, consider it like that. Like, okay, you've got 24 minutes to keep moving. Let's say you're walking around McKinley Park or something. 24 minutes if I was walking still kind of normal pace, maybe I'd make it around, could make it around the park twice, possibly, really. That would be 2 miles. I'd still have to walk pretty fast. Okay. So when you're doing Shamatha, don't think about rushing. Think, you know, leisurely, like a walk where you're moving forward. You're not doing like slow walking meditation, but you won't be able to sprint this one. I don't know. Are there any marathon people here? Maybe marathon. No marathon. Yeah. I can't, you know, I wouldn't be able to keep running for 24 minutes. Half marathon, yeah. So in doing a 24-minute meditation, there's going to be times where you'll drift off and then come back, right? So you want to give yourself permission, not to do it necessarily, but permission to, like, not judge it. If you walk around McKinley Park a couple of times, sometimes you'll be a little distracted, perhaps, but you're not going to walk into the street, right? You're not going to bump into people necessarily. I don't know, maybe I might, I don't know. You're not going to walk into a tree. So not walking into the street, staying on the path, not bumping into people is walking the path. You don't have to be micromanaging every thought. Just when you notice, oh, I'm starting to veer off a little bit, I'm about to walk into a tree, then you bring yourself back, right? You're not trying to, like, grab and let go or redirect every time you have a thought. Some people do that. Like, they say, Lamala, I had a couple of thoughts. And I go, that's all? No, you're going to have many thoughts. The important thing is you're not so involved in the thoughts that you walk into the street. You're not so involved with the thoughts that you forget to take the exit to the Bay Bridge. Has anybody ever forgotten to take the exit to the Bay Bridge, you know, and you end up going down 580? That sucks, because there's not an easy turnaround, right? Yeah. So in doing this practice, we're not micromanaging ourselves. We're not trying to double down and be really, you know, like a cat watching a mouse hole. That's not mindfulness. That's not calm abiding practice. Or it's like you're walking meditation, but you're staying on the path. You know, you're not bumping into people. You're not tripping over something. But it doesn't mean you're micromanaging every thought. And then it's enjoyable. So shamatha meditation in Tibetan is called shine, calm abiding. So it's meant to be like a nice walk. It's not meant to be like a cat watching a mouse hole. So you're being aware instead of be aware. Easy, right? No, yeah. So shamatha is just like the Buddha said, not too tight, not too loose. Middle way. So a good metaphor for meditation is actually walking. You're walking fast enough so you're not falling over. If you walk too slow, right, you'll kind of lose it. If you bicycle too slow, you'll lose it. So you're keeping some momentum, but you're not trying to micromanage every thought. Did I say everything 3 times? Okay. That's traditional. This is a workshop, so we get to talk about it. We'll be doing next month a retreat at Lotus View Ranch. So I'll be giving some teachings, but generally, like a retreat, you're not like doing yogi shop talk, right? You're just, we're processing it also kind of by ourselves in a way, right? So the nice part about like workshops like this, like we do yogi shop talk, like questions and answers. Yes.
Well, I had a question. I guess it's a question. I'm just curious. I used to sit a lot of time, and I would be able to count my breath, and 200 breaths would be about 25 minutes. And I'd sit for 200 breaths, and I could and count. But I found that I was doing that again, and if I could, if I held the count after the breath, I mean, if I did the whole breath and made the count, it was difficult. What I found myself falling into was inhale and exhale on the number.
Okay.
And then it became rote. I don't know. But as soon as I tried to just focus on the whole breath, I would lose the count. And again, I don't know what that is. If I, that would be the extent of my attention span, or if I should. Try to tighten that up or let that go. It seems easy to count the breath by just inhale and then exhale one. If I make a complete concentration on the breath, then I say the count after I breathe. It seems like that's a whole other dimension. I don't know why, but it seems like another whole minute. But,
I mean, counting is kind of a noting process that just gives us a little bit more reference point to let us know whether we're drifting or not. So it's not an end in itself, you know, because it's easy sometimes in shamatha saying, okay, paying attention to breath, but breath can be a very wide trail, right? So we can kind of have very little attention and still not fall over. So the counting gives us a little bit more something for the mind to do, but also a little bit like noticing, like, oh, I lost count. Where sometimes when we're just paying attention, using the breath as an object, it's easy to just be a little bit lazy or a little bit too dull. So the counting gives a little bit more to do. Generally we're not like counting past 21 or something. But what you're saying is like you do the breath and then at the end count one or something. Yeah. I don't think you have to like do like one or two like that. I don't think you have to like do a long one or something. I think it would be a little different because you're kind of like carrying it along. Just like if you're doing a mantra on the out breath rather than just paying attention to the out breath, it adds a little bit more flavor. Yeah. So generally, I advise people doing an out-breath so the in-breath, nothing is happening. At least we're having some kind of gap there. But in any case, in shamatha, the old idea is we're learning to balance our awareness, have a balanced attentiveness that isn't too tight or too loose, isn't too depressed or flat and dull, isn't too excited and jumpy. And we watch our practice, we're usually veering to one side or the other. So this even balanced awareness is that's very serviceable is what we're after in shamatha. So that when we want to put the attention somewhere, it'll stay there without effort, and when we want to move it, it stays there without effort. So we need that kind of serviceability in order to start doing, you know, vipassana, to do panoramic awareness and to start noticing other things going on in the environment of our awareness, in kind of Hinayana mindfulness or Spirit Rock mindfulness. The teaching is more on the, developing insight into the phenomena, right? Noticing that things change, noticing that you know, we're suffering if we're clinging, things like that. Here we're just really working on bare attention at first, and then we're developing a little bit more like, okay, what's in our inner room, so to speak. So the counting, you know, you could count both in and out if you want to, or you could count at the end. But the question is, do you lose count? Yeah, and then you notice like, oh, well, you know, I lost count, which is in a way good news because then we come back to the present. In any case, Shaman is always in the present. Here in Sacramento, the present. So in our tradition, we generally have our eyes open so we don't lose present focus. But I never go around trying to open people's eyes, you know, never. Tempting. It's kind of like, okay, open up. If we don't practice being in the present to start with, when we start doing Mahamudra practice, how are we ever going to be in the present? If you've practiced for years and years and years, like using the meditation practice to be somewhere else, and then you try to get yourself back in the present, it's really difficult. So even though we might drift a lot, we're always coming back to just being right here. So the counting just helps that. So in a way, losing count might be good because you're noticing losing count. So if you get really good at losing, if you get really good at counting so that you don't really have to pay attention to counting very much and you never lose count, then it's losing its purpose in a sense, right? You know, if you get so good at it that it's like it just follows along, then it's not so good. Hello. Well, okay. Traditional shamatha, which I like, is at most, you know, you're going to count 21 breaths just to get present, and then you drop it. You're not counting after that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're just kind of like, okay, I'm pretty discursive, so, you know, I'm just going to count to settle down. And in traditional shamatha, which again I like, breath is not the meditation object. A mental image of the Buddha is generally the meditation object, which we're going to do in a minute. But so, you know, breathing and counting is seen as like really just kind of training wheels, and then we're on to doing, you know, visualizing a mental image.
Yeah. so and that, and then again, so like you're attached to looking at these bright colors and these interesting shapes, and they're, you know, and doing it with the breath, which is a whole different class. But in any case, that doesn't seem like that's really effective either, because you're just doing these visualization things.
Oh, that was a good one. You don't do that
one very well. And, you know, I mean, no. That was a sloppy. Well, I just imagine
you're
food and you just start skipping over.
Yeah.
Visualization is the same thing. I use the numbers as a focus, and then there's the falling away, and then that space becomes, what is that space? Is that just drifting, or is that my shamatha? Shamatha seemed to be very, when I first came to discover shamatha, it seemed to be just a vast space that I walked into, but it was because there was no concentration or focus, it was just, it was then I would use visualization, I would use a Buddha, and then work on the focus of that, and that became very narrow. And I don't know if I go between the two of them, I'm open now to responsive in the sense of finding things open up, rather than trying to think about them, but it's still a focus on whatever the object is. And it does seem to be a different brain pattern in meditation, if that's a different meditation.
Okay. In our tradition, why is it the fast, we call it the fast track, fast path, because we unite appearance and non-appearance at the same time. See, most practices, you're saying either I'm visualizing or I'm not visualizing, right? Usually think I'm just doing mind only practice and I'm doing visualizing, but actually, like right now, you're aware and you see objects. So emptiness and appearance are the same. That's the fast track. We don't have to separate things, but initially you do have to separate things. But ultimately, it doesn't, like whether you're meditating with form or meditating with no form, they're both empty, right? And they're both united. So many times in America, people are doing what they classify as formless meditations. Like, I don't do ritual, I don't do visualizations, I'm just sitting. But they're not getting anywhere because it's just one part of reality. I mean, the minute you open your eyes, you see phenomena in form. So if that's a problem, then you're going to have a problem. So in our tradition, appearance and non-appearance, form and no form, both the same. So in Mahamudra, they're both the same. Both same, 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 same. So, but because we're dualistic creatures, sometimes we have to, like, you know, kind of a little bit notice over here, this is the formless side, and this is kind of the form side. But ultimately, form and formless, same. Okay, but you know, people kind of get, you know, trippy. And in Asia, generally people are going to start out with form meditations, right? You're not going to start out with shamatha. You're not going to start out with just bare attention like here in the West. But because in the West, my idea is that, you know, so many people have negative views of religion and get all tripped up on stuff. They like having, you know, kind of more, seems more scientific to be formless. Because whenever you visualize something, it always has a particular meaning or a particular content. But that's a bias. So whether we're visualizing or not visualizing, it's both the nature of mind. There are, from one aspect, we could say mind has absolutely no form whatsoever. But from another side, it does have form. So in Tantra, the fast path, we're seeing both simultaneously. And not seeing the difference. But you can see difference, but they're still same. So, but to train, sometimes we have to like, sometimes put our hand this way. Oh, it feels like this when I'm this, when we're sticking our hand outside the car, and sometimes it feels like this. To see the nature of mind, sometimes we have to concentrate on the form aspect of it. And to see nature of mind, sometimes we have to, concentrate on the formless aspect. And also people's different Buddha families and personality characteristics. I mean, some people are going to tendency towards I'd like to meditate with form, or I don't want to meditate with form. You know, people have their personality characteristics or their religious upbringing, you know, or something like that. Like, I don't want to meditate on a Buddha form because that looks religious, you know, and that doesn't seem scientific. I just want to meditate on nature and mind, and, you know, that's breath, seems scientific, and, all our, trippy explanations, but it's still the same when we come to the higher teachings, which is the start of Tantra. So anytime we're doing Tantra, visualizing Buddha Devas, visualizing winds, channels, and drops, doing Mahamudra and Dzogchen, we're always, even Heart Sutra, of course, form and emptiness are the same, which really means form and non-form, both empty, both without, own being from its own side. So that's interesting, isn't it? Well, whether you count or don't count is going to be a matter of technique, but in any case, whether it's form or formless emptiness, form emptiness or formless emptiness, it's always going to be in the present. That much we're always going to come back to. There's no way to be meditating either really in the future or the past, actually. Sorry, you're stuck, That's good news. Even if you think you're thinking about the past or thinking about the future or delusional, it's all happening in the present. There's no exit. So sometimes we really emphasize in the Tantra path, like, you are stuck. There's no exit. There's no freedom. You're stuck in the present. There's no way out of the enlightenment. You can't renounce Buddhahood. You can't say, I'm tired of being, I'm tired of being an awake being. I just want to go to sleep again. I wish I was a cat or something. You can't go backwards. You're stuck. So, accept it and get on with it, So that's kind of Tantra way of talking. Like, you're condemned to be free, using existentialist kind of viewpoint. Yeah. So, okay, well, what does it mean to you?
Huh?
Okay, well, what does it mean to you?
Well, like, there's present and there's aware. They're not necessarily the same.
Could you say focused versus
non-focused? Maybe. But if you're strong on visualization, and you're strong on counting, or you're strong on just nature of mind, you're still present and aware of the train going by and your neighbor fidgeting and the fact that you just did a really long breath as opposed to a really short breath.
Mm-hmm.
So you're like aware and present with that stuff. That's what I mean by present. But then you're also likely wrapped up and really focused on some visualization. And it's sharp and it's you know, all that. So, what's form and what's emptiness? What's present and what's aware? What is that? In your mind, what's doing? Oh.
Well, just kind of overview. in English or American or whatever, we haven't got the precision of the Sanskrit or Tibetan, and we haven't got the agreement among the terms. You know, so that's you know part of evolution of Dharma is you know we're. When we're using these specialized terminology, what do we really mean? Where in India and Tibet, they had hundreds of years to work out, you know, like here's what we mean by this and that, you know, we're still working that out. that's an overview.
Oh, okay.
That because we're not going to totally nail this one down, okay? Oh. You know. We have to be really, you know, we have to be really honest about it. So, one of the ways of thinking about form is that, we can talk about the back and the front of it. Okay, you know, this has form because we can think about the back or the front. You know, is it facing east or west or something like that, right? In other words, we can locate it directionally. Whereas awareness or attention or we can't quite locate directionally. Okay. So There are some phenomena that aren't quite form, you see, because we can be aware of phenomena that don't have form. Okay, so because they don't have a direction, like emptiness, we can be aware of emptiness, a non-affirming negative, but it doesn't have a direction, right? But when we're talking about like now and presence, it's also complicated a little bit by, you know, we have to say, well, are we talking from this point of view or that point of view? If we're talking about from kind of Abhidharma Hinayana point of view, we could say it means this. If we're talking about Mahayana view, it means this. If we're talking about Dzogchen point of view, it means this, you know. So, you know, like sometimes one translator I kind of like a little bit, like Keith Dauman says, you know, likes translating Yeshe or Jhana as awareness of now. And then translating Rigpa as presence, you see. So, you know, then well, what's the difference there? You know, like that, and then you know, then when you're talking Dzogchen or Mahamudra, then you're really drilling down into these specific things. But one way thinking about awareness of now is that there's some sense where we're just awake right now, no matter what we're thinking about. But are you really present? So, and then do you know what you're doing? So there are little different aspects, and, you know, that's probably beyond what we're doing today, but we do eventually start thinking that way. Like this presence and awareness and knowing, and a little bit different. Let alone just mindfulness or drenpa or sheshin's the Tibetan for what Dalai Lama likes to say introspection, right? self-mindfulness in Sanskrit is, you know, sati, right? You're not forgetting what you're doing. And mind, you know, so we translated that a long time ago. Somebody said, oh, that's mindfulness. So it's stuck in English. And Tibetan, it's drampa, like that. But then there's this other funny thing where I call it coming out from little angle, where Shenshin in Tibetan, which is you're kind of noticing, you're still mindful, like I'm looking at the door right now, but so I'm mindful of it, but is my perception really clear, or am I kind of still a little bit dull about it, or still a little bit agitated? So if somebody says, what are you doing? I can say, well, I'm looking at the door, but the Shenshin, the introspection would be, well, am I really notice, you know, am I really, you know, that clear about it? Or am I just able to identify it as a door? Or Shenshin would go, okay, well, it's a brown door, and it has like, you know, three panels, the one in the middle is bigger, and one at the top's, you know, like this. It has the, you know, latches up and bottom, you know, like you're really getting into the detail of it. So, but all those are going to be under these big umbrellas of being, you know, aware and being knowing and being present, things like that. Maybe we need some kind of like little colored Venn diagrams. Do you think I'd do that? These are important because, you know, it looks academic, but it makes a big difference in our personal life and relationships, you know. It happens all the time with couples. You know, usually, okay, this is kind of typecast, but usually the wife or partner is going to say, you're just not paying attention when I'm talking to you. And the guy's going, I'm right here. What do you mean? Okay? You know, so those are different, you know, they're a little operating from a little different sphere. And she's like, well, I know you're right there, but I don't really think you care what I'm saying. No, I really do care. You know, so that's another aspect of mine. Or the person's going, you know, you say you're really there, but I don't feel it. You know, so each one has, you know, it looks academic when we're trying to parse these kind of aspects out. But in relationships, intimate relationships, let alone business or social, it really makes a difference. Like if you're going out to lunch with someone you're kind of just like an aspect of watching, somebody will feel weird, like, well, why are you watching me eat, right? So when you go out with a friend, you don't want to be inspected. But if you go out with a friend and they're kind of there, but like maybe guys are more likely to do this, like people walk by and you're talking and they're turning their head, you know, you know, go, well, I'm sorry, are you waiting for somebody, or was that person really interesting, you know, or am I boring, you know? So that's an aspect of mind, a distraction. So we'd say to the person, you know, I don't feel you're really present for a conversation. And the person might go, no, I'm really here, or, you know, like that. So when we know how it really works, we can say to somebody, you know, I get that you're paying attention to me, you're getting the information, but maybe you don't feel really present. Things like that. So we're learning these aspects of mind and body and emotions in a very kind of, here's how the tools work, but we really are using them in our daily life. And they make a huge difference. Because we don't like it if we're just talking to somebody and they're physically there, but they don't feel like they're paying attention, right? That's really annoying. We're much more like, if we feel someone's like doing something else, even though they're sitting there and they're not pretending they're paying attention, we'll cut them some slack, right? We'll say, you know, would you please get off your device? Right? Like that, you know? So we're using all these terms, we're using all these aspects of the mind, but usually we're not using them, you know, really consciously. We don't really know how the mind works and the emotions work. So, you know, we're not able to, you know, really be precise or hit the nail on the head. Or even on a more basic level, you know, sometimes, you know, maybe someone's lying in bed and, you know, it's funny how we say, are you awake? You know, that's what we say Buddhism, you know, awakeism, you know, Buddha, are you awake? You know, on an even basic level, are you awake? You know, that's really the most basic level. Or, you know, we could say, are you dead? You know, it's like, as people know that I've worked in hospitals and are working now in hospital, it's kind of a weird experience going to a patient's room and you're not quite sure, right? You know what I'm saying, right? You know, it's kind of like really quiet. And, you know, these days with all the devices, you know, you're going to hear beeps and things like that. But, you know, that's the most basic question, kind of like, are you alive or dead, you know? Are you awake or asleep? And then the functions kind of, you know, like in the hospital, like, okay, that person's, let's say they're just, you know, drugged up, coming out of surgery, or they've had a coma or something, and then, you know, we were saying, you know, is Uncle Jimmy, was he able to, you know, did he know what you were saying? No, he's in a coma. Oh, okay. You know, Uncle Jimmy, did he know you were there? Or Aunt Sally, is there Alzheimer's totally gone? Yeah, no, she knew who I was, you know. So these really important mental functions have huge implications for our life. So it's really important question. We need to, like, make a little color graph. Okay, we'll make a little. Yeah. In Sanskrit, there's hundreds of names for these emotional and intellectual functions, and in Tibetan too, and we use a fraction of them in English. And the problem is we use very broad terms for things that are really divided up. Is like, I don't know if it's true now, but they say, you know, the Inuits, the Eskimos would have like 20 names for the snow or something, and we just have snow, you know. So, you know, it'd be like everyone's color from Dharma point of view, if we only use a couple of words like mind or something, then it'd be like saying everybody's wearing the same clothes. We wouldn't have any distinctions at all. Yeah, you do. Yeah, so, you know, as kids, we learn to have certain hierarchies of things that we get very, very perceptive to. Most kids and adults, too, are going to end up being somewhat perceptive about, like, people's moods, right? In America, we're more very mood-oriented, so we might be going, you know, you don't look happy with me right now, or you look sad, or you're mugging me, or you look angry. You know, we tend to have more emotional languages usually than attention languages. So we're developing that. Yes.
Keep that sort of a mind
Yeah, that's, you know, that's, you know, one definition of like samadhi is one pointed mind, you know, or the ability and shamatha to come to a point. So I spend a lot of my professional work working with people with, you know, developmental disabilities, mild mental or major mental retardation, major autistic spectrum things. And when people can't pay attention, guess what? You're totally out of luck. If you cannot concentrate or pay attention, you're SOL. You're disabled. You can't do a thing. And if you can't remember anything on top of paying attention, you're completely, you're done, right? You've got Alzheimer's and you can't concentrate. You're not going anywhere. Isn't that right? So we have to have those two functions developed, the ability to remember and the ability to focus, pay attention, concentrate, or not able to function at all. You know, we would be Buddhas with comas, or Buddhas with Alzheimer's, or Buddhas with Asperger's, or something. You see, you know, to bring all the, like, being present, being aware, being attentive, knowing what's going on, to bring all those together at one time, you know, it does take some discipline. So that's when you feel people are really kind of with it or present, that they're, or, you know, really good when they're bringing all those together at the same part, you know, which includes the emotional, you know, of course. But we have to be able to remember and concentrate at a minimum, or, you know, we're really in trouble. Because people with, you know, kind of high-functioning autism, you don't feel like quite relating, you know? They're like, they're not maybe getting the emotional, social cues, but they're not totally disabled, right? But you want someone with, who's kind of autistic, you know, you get the idea that something's kind of lacking, like they're not totally present for you, right? Because when you're working with someone who has autism, it's a little bit like you're talking to somebody in the Borg from Star Trek. They're kind of there and doing their functioning, but it's not like you're not like a total another human being for them. So that's the aspect of being present, you know, when you're talking about presence, like Rigpa, you know, that you feel that person's recognizing you as they're, you know. So when somebody has, you know, kind of Asperger's, you know, they're obviously kind of being attentive because they're talking about certain things and very focused on certain things, right? When you're talking about games and all these details about things, but you don't feel that quality of presence because there's not the acknowledgement that you're really there. It's interesting. We should do a little walking and break, and then we'll do a final sitting and practice. How's that? Yes.
Well, I don't know. Again, this was just my mind going all over. It's just amazing just to watch the different variations of mindful walking. When I was first taught, it was very regimented. This was, I guess, it was Zen style. And it was like placing the foot, lifting the foot, rolling the weight. You know, there was just an actual sequence, and you were very concentrated on the style.
Mm-hmm.
And then, in this tradition, I tend to be more open. It's kind of like just a walk. And I was doing like a Monty Pelmy hum with my mind. And then I see different styles. And there was a style in Arizona and New Mexico that everyone walked a body length apart, and everyone moved with the same foot. You wanted just a caterpillar. Mm-hmm. And you really had to pay attention because you would get run over, you know, like at a fairly fast pace. I mean, you know, what aspect of the mind are you training? And all these different things, there's just so many different things. So I pretty much, I try to stick with one kind of focus at a time, I guess. Everything's got everything.
It's intimate. It is. I'm glad everyone here is willing to do, you know, look at the level of our existence, you know, in this detail and this depth, you know, because we could all be out shopping or doing something. And so I want to talk a little bit about visualization practice, and then, you know, so like I'm just seeing you right now, everyone. So I'm visualizing you right now. You're just appearing to me. So that's important. Like from a Buddhist point of view, we're not saying like anybody's there in a sense. We're just saying you're appearing there. Now I know I feel here. And you feel there, and you probably feel where you are, and I'm here, or there. But, you know, we're just saying, well, you know, you're appearing. So that's the most basic thing about appearance. You're just appearing. Then in... You know, that's a really good question. You know, actually, on a very basic level, we're constantly appearing and disappearing. On an atomic level, we're kind of like coming in, going out, you know, just all the time. It's just happening so fast, it appears solid. And our mind, too, is like that also. It's permanent in the sense that it's ongoing, but it's flashing like that. It's like a, you know, one of those flashing lights so the airplanes see you on the tower. It's going beep, 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 beep. So we're appearing, disappearing, appearing, disappearing. Yes, that's it. It's just very micro. So we get the assumption that it's solid, but it's very fast appearing, disappearing. So we could say, hi, you're appearing, disappearing. Welcome, you know, hi, it's appearing, disappearing. You're appearing, disappearing person. It's happening very fast. But there's as much disappearing as appearing going on.
Could you use the analogy of like a spinning bike wheel with spokes? As it's spinning faster, it looks like it's a solid wheel. And you slow it down, you see this separation.
Yeah. You can't see that. It's moving so rapidly. Yeah, it looks solid. In fact, you know, sometimes things are spinning so fast that it looks like it's going backwards because our gross levels of mind can't compute that fast, you know. So it appears going backwards. You know, it's like an optical illusion. Yes. Yeah, flashing very quickly. Yeah.
It's flashing in and out of the distance.
Yeah.
If you take it down to a fourth level, it's just beyond any kind of comprehension.
Yeah. Yeah, but we can talk about it.
So it's probably how we that process is happening in how we change.
Yeah. Yeah, we're changing because things are flashing. Yeah, the rhythm changes. And it's like, and yeah, from Buddha's point of view, if we're not here, we're everywhere. But there's also a sense if you're appearing here, you're appearing everywhere too, you know. So you know, but just for shamatha point of view, I'll just be very concrete. Is that so? Okay, so you're appearing here. So you know, when we're doing shamatha meditation, the most typical is, you know, we're doing a visualization of like the Buddha in this refuge, earth touching pose, right? So we're doing a visualization, except you know, the Buddha is somewhat idealized form, right? But still, there's a sense, just like we saw the Buddha in person, that the Buddha is really there. So that's an important thing in visualization, you know, however, is the appearance is also really present. So it isn't just like, well, I'm visualizing the Buddha, but it's just kind of a whatever, you know. No, it's at the same time really present, and that's where we come to the present thing. Using mind is present. Because we could say, well, we're visualizing a picture of the Buddha, or I'm visualizing the Buddha, but the Buddha's not really here. No, we're also, you know, it's like totally here. So I'm visualizing you guys, and you're totally here too. Okay. Yes. Yeah. So, you know, you can say, well, okay, in Nirmanakaya, that's a name for like, a, you know, like manifestation bodies. Like, we're all in our, you know, manifestation bodies. But then we're visualizing in different ways. And one way, of course, is we're visualizing like kind of a holograph in front of us, right? Sometimes that's the way, like, we kind of like, you know, Star Trek, you're coming off the transporter, and, you know, or, you know, something like that. You know, that kind of level. That's one style. The style that's generally used for shamatha, however, is like a more mental visualization. So we're not trying to like project it in front of us, but it's like right now, I'm sure we can all visualize our kitchen. But that doesn't mean we're bringing our kitchen right here in front of us, right? We can just say, okay, this is what my kitchen looks like. I just say kitchen, and there we are. Or I can say Golden Gate Bridge, and you just kind of like, you could bring up a visualization. But that doesn't mean we're visualizing the Golden Gate Bridge, you know, an arm's length in front of us and this size, right? But lots of times that's how visualization is started, right? You've seen the Golden Gate Bridge, you've seen the Buddha, then you can visualize, you know, kind of like hologram in front of you, right? And then the third stage is you're just able to hold a mental image. But it doesn't mean it's necessarily in front of you. Like you can probably, everyone can visualize, like, here's what my kitchen looks like, right? But you don't have to put it in front of you. You don't have to bring your kitchen into the Gompi here to see it, right? You just get it. It's a mess. You can visualize the dishes in the sink right now. And it's there, okay? You know, you don't have to necessarily, I mean, you know the kitchen's in the house, but you don't have to create any kind of particular context around it or say, you know, like, you're not going to say the kitchen's in my head and my head's gotten heavy or something. It's just, you can just see it right away. Isn't that so? Okay, but that's totally a mental image, right? You're not trying to make it a sight image necessarily. You're not trying to make it. It's not like it's being transported in the transporter room and it's kind of shimmering as it appears in front of you, and then we send it back, you know? But of course, in the sadhanas we do, like, we start out that way of, you know, the Buddhas kind of show up and then they go back, and because we're doing it in stages, right? But in, you know, if someone's been practicing a while, then we're just doing shamatha just on a mental image. So we're not trying to visualize the Buddha necessarily in front of us. We can just see the Buddha with the mind's eye, see this form, right, with the mind's eye. But it's not like some three-dimensional holographic thing in front of us. It's just like we visualize our kitchen. It's just there.
So if I'm drawing and I'm visualizing, and it's 3D and it's
Well, it's a hologram if we think of it's in front of us, you know, like, yeah, but.
But then, if I just sort of visualize it, just like this, all these spheres, then it's not there. It's just, it's a different thing.
That's the mental image, but it still could be three-dimensional, but it's just appearing. You know, we're not like, it's not like it, you know, it could still be shimmering, but it's just appearing. So, yeah. So this is a little bit different, right? Little, you know, like seeing, you're just seeing concrete, then you might visualize that someone is kind of, you know, somewhat, you know, kind of like a hologram or made out of light, and then sometimes you just, it's just appearing in the mind's eye.
There is.
So usually, like with Buddhist things, like that's why we have all the paintings, or that's why you'd be meditating in front of your altar. So, you know, you're looking constantly at, you know, physical representation, so it's not so hard to get. Where in the West, we didn't usually grow up with it. But most people in the West can, you know, visualize Santa Claus or something, just because we're so familiar. So it is important we get familiar with the image so that eventually we can make it into a generic image. Like right now, so it's not even just... The fourth thing, in a way, isn't just an image of the Buddha, but it's also a generic image, right? So I can say tree, and you don't have to visualize any particular tree. You could make up a tree, right? You don't have to go, well, I got to go out and look at a tree, and look at it for a while, then visualize it kind of sparkling in front of me, and then I'll have the mental image of the tree, and then I can do tree. No, you can just do tree. You can kind of make up a tree, right? We're all on the same page there. You can do that. Okay. So you have actual, you know, physical tree, you have holographic tree, you have mental image of that exact tree, and then you just have generic tree. Why are we doing all this? Because when you get to the level of generic image, it becomes a lot easier, in a sense, in this system, to see that form and formless, visualization or not visualization, both in nature and mind. Because you've gotten to a place where, wow, I can just generate generic image, which is mind-generated, right? You don't have to see the tree first, right? We just say tree, and you got it. So we don't have to go out and physically see it. So we're going, oh, that is really weird. We are able to completely generate an image without any outside. That's telling us something about nature, mind, and how it works. That's why we do it. Yes? There's no other way it really manifests, but we have to take things down to a very basic level, just like in scientific, you know, we kind of go, okay, well, looks like everything's solid, but it's really these electrical charges, pulsating things we call atoms or molecules or something, which we generally don't see because we're just seeing the gross level of things, but we still retain that. So even though the Earth looks flat, we're retaining the idea that, you know, that it's spherical, right? So, usually when we're saying form, it means we're distinguishing colors. Yes. Of course, yeah. It's hard. No, form is colors.
Form is colors.
Yeah.
And formless?
No colors. We can see things because they're all colored, you see. Like there's shiny, that color, and there's maroon, that color. You don't really see edges, you see colors. You see form. So form doesn't mean, you know, like little lines. And Buddhists think form means you're seeing, you know, colored patches that are distinguished. But space doesn't have any color, right? It's formless. Yeah. When we get to the level of generic image, it's easier to see the sameness of form and formless. They're both empty. Usually we're always dualistic. We're always thinking, well, the stuff that's solid and then the space that's not. And that's a big problem. We get... Yeah, it isn't that way. But, you know, usually, you know, the big problem is I'm here and you're there. And... You know, so by working on this very deep level of our being, we get to see the fundamental structures, how everything arises interdependently. It makes it a lot easier to get along with people. It's not just, you know, mental gymnastics. I mean, like where we can the mind becomes very flexible and present, emotions flexible and present. Which is what people like. They want us to be, you know, friends are flexible and present, right? Friends go, okay, you're going this way, you're going that way, I'm with you, and we like it. Lovers are flexible and present, right? We don't like it when people are stiff, distant, right? We like people that are free and connected. That's what human beings like. Isn't that so? We all want to feel embraced and free at the same time. We all want to feel, you know, those two things at the same time, free and connected. Everyone wants that. But usually they're separated, you know, like, I can only be free if I'm living alone, you know, because people get on my case. But then I get lonely, so I get with people that are mean, nasty, and codependent, and then I feel smothered, you know, and then I break up again, and, you know, I was like, that's samsara, right? So we want to be with others, connected, but we want to feel free. That's the whole thing. Oh, dear. So let's just take 5 minutes. We have Buddha image here. If you have your prayer book, then you can visualize. You never do it flat, by the way. You know, so either like visualize Buddha in front, or holograph, or just image. And that, instead of putting your attention on your breath, you're putting it on the image, the form, okay? Easy? We do it all the time with things we want, you know, you visualize, okay, I'm going to Costco, I'm getting, you know, getting this bag of potato chips, you know, and we visualize it. You know, so you're doing it all the time. Yeah. At least a couple of minutes as part of your practice, do some of this, you know. So you're doing breath, which usually kind of gets us headed in the right direction, and then just do a little bit, right? It takes a little bit more skill for most people, but when you think about it, like, we're very easy able to do, fix on a certain visualization when we're really, like, kind of infatuated with someone or angry with them or we're traumatized, right? Then the image becomes somewhat fixated, but it also becomes problematic, right? So that's why we're so attracted to those states, because in a way the mind likes to have that kind of stability, except it's samsaric stability, right? It's fixation. So we're always moving from a little bit, you know, entropy energy from fixation to stability. That's all we're doing. It's that simple. Okay, let's do prayers. Any virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha, lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, Bodhicitta, that has not arisen, arise and grow. And may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. Teachings of the Buddha flourish. May the upholders of the teachings remain forever. May all migrators achieve happiness, and they may fulfill all their temporary and ultimate goals. Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of objectless compassion, Manjushri, master of flawless wisdom, Vajrapani, destroyer of the entire hosts of Maras, Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of snowy land sages, Losang Drakpa, I make request at your holy feet. Thanks, everybody. I'm going to hang out a little bit, so if anyone wants to say hi, I'll be in the Tara Library office.